We are heading out to sea.
Yes.
And however it'll be, it ain't gonna be the same. 'Cause no matter what we see when we're out there on the sea, we ain't gonna see a dame.
All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, my two compatriots, there is our benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Raup.
Hello, glad to be here.
And we also have Will Graham.
Woohoo!
Woo! We are here today to talk about the Coen Brothers' new film, that is Hail Caesar, starring just about every single person in Hollywood. Not going to go through it right now. And before we get into that usual stuff, like us on Facebook? Yeah, you can do that. Also, give us a rating and a review on iTunes. And email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you have anything you have to say to us, or you can follow us on Twitter at @filmstageshow. That is pretty much it, gentlemen. How are things going?
Good. I saw Hail Caesar, so I'm doing pretty well.
All right. Well, there's a spoiler for Jordan's review of the film. And today all we're gonna do is talk about Hail Caesar, the newest film by Joel and Ethan Coen, and it stars Josh Brolin, George Clooney, Alden Ehrenreich?
Yep.
Okay. Ralph Fiennes, Ralph Fiennes. I hate everyone in this movie should die right now. Scarlett Johansson, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, Channing Tatum, Jonah Hill, Allison Pill, Fisher Stevens. There's a lot of people is what I'm trying to get across. It is a film that focuses on Eddie Mannix, who is played by Josh Brolin, who has worked with the Coens before in No Country for Old Men, and he is charged with keeping productions running smoothly and dealing with the capricious whims of all of the stars and handling all the bullshit that they get into. So,
often. You're not that bad.
Here at Capitol Pictures, as you know, millions of people look to us for information and uplift and, yes, entertainment. And we're going to give it to them.
And action.
An army of technicians and actors and top-notch artistic people are working hard to bring to the screen our biggest release of the year. Hail Caesar is a prestige picture with one of the biggest stars in the world, Baird Whitlock.
A truth we could see if we had, but if we faith, cut.
All right, Hail Caesar, newest film from the Coen brothers. These are, I would say, every cinephile's like best friends. Their movies are looked forward to years in advance. Trailers watched many, many times before the film has even hit theaters. So let's see if they keep up the streak. Jordan Raup, what did you think of Hail Caesar?
Yeah, so, I mean, you could guess that I liked it a lot. I think with the Coens, they kind of, all their films had this kind of overlay of just like surface pleasures, you could say, that make them very enjoyable. Whether even in Inside Llewyn Davis, which is a much gloomier film than this, if you enjoyed the folk music there, and with any number of their films, they have something like that. And this one is, you know, probably the most pronounced of their career, where they're literally remaking fake movies. So not really remaking, but making them for the first time. And there's a lot of enjoyment to be found there with the characters, but there's also kind of the underlying themes that kind of are just supplanted in all of their work. And this one, it kind of has Josh Brolin, you know, dealing with this religious aspect of if he's doing what he's doing is right. I mean, the film opens literally with Jesus on a cross. And I think it's kind of interesting to think of him, you know, almost like a figure like that for the studio itself. He's going through all these the industry players and their many sins and trying to fix them. And I think that that's a very interesting dynamic that we can talk about further, especially in spoilers and things like that. But yeah, on the surface, it's an extremely fun movie. And I think, as with every Coen Brothers movie, in the years to come, there will be a lot more to mine from the experience. And yeah, so I, fantastic film. I can see why it didn't really connect well with audiences. I think it got a C- cinema score.
Yes. And for anyone who doesn't know, cinema score is basically like polling people on the way out of the theater to see what they thought of a film. Generally, everything gets a good mark on cinema score because the assumption is that you knew what you were getting when you went in.
Yeah, sure. And some of my favorite films get low scores. So,
like The Counselor.
Yeah, The Counselor, Killing Them Softly. So, and this, it's kind of a little bit strange just because I think this is very enjoyable. I would recommend this to anyone really. So it is kind of strange in that aspect. When you talk about a star-studded kind of, comedy, some of these stars are in the movie for maybe no more than 2 minutes. So maybe people were thrown off by that. And I think with the 50s recreation of movies, they do it in a really, really reverent way, which means these 3 to 4 minute or more sequences that are literally just, they're not poking fun necessarily at the movies, but they're recreating them kind of lovingly. So I think that could throw people off that weren't expecting. But yeah, I can wrap up my initial thoughts there.
All right. Bill Graham, what about you? What did you think of Hail Caesar?
One thing that I definitely want to note, that if anybody that, hasn't seen the trailers or things like that, and Jordan was mentioning it, they really go through a lot of effort of like recreating these sets and recreating the typical Hollywood backlots that you kind of, imagine in the 50s and 60s that they were kind of working off of. The sets are gorgeous. They're very interesting the way that I personally, I love any time a movie has scenes shooting another movie. I just love seeing kind of the set, and for a lot of people, that is literally the only way that they ever see an actual set like that. Even the behind the scenes documentaries and stuff like that, a lot of the times you don't see that kind of stuff. So this is really, kind of showing how the sausage is made. And I think they do a really good job of kind of recreating that feel and recreating that atmosphere, whether it's through the clothings, whether it's through the way that people talk. But I think this is definitely a surface level movie that you can enjoy to a large extent. I don't think the Coens for me are a filmmaking duo that it takes a couple of watches to really unlock what's going on in the film and things like that. Cause I mean, one of my favorite films from them is The Big Lebowski. And that film, when I first watched it, I didn't understand why so many people liked it as much as they did. I laughed a few times, and the more and more I watched it, the funnier and funnier it got. It really kind of unlocks itself over time. And so I think this is another one of those films that maybe a lot of people upon initial visit won't necessarily understand or enjoy quite as much if they gave it time to kind of develop over time. And unfortunately, I've only seen this once so far. I think the acting is very good, and I think the plotting is a little bit confusing, as some of the Coen Brothers films generally are. There's a lot of things being thrown at the audience that don't have any kind of a real bearing on the plot or on the story itself, and it kind of gets in the way a little bit more, I think, in this film in particular. But overall, it's a fun ride, but it's hard for me to widely recommend it at this point. But I'm curious to see what kind of happens with it the more I watch it and the more it kind of develops over time.
Yeah. I thought this movie was fine. That's like it. There's really not a lot more for me to say. It's Inside Llewyn Davis was a movie that I didn't enjoy at the time, but I had a lot of feelings about and really wanted to explore. And if I remember correctly, I think that Nick Newman hilariously didn't realize that the last scene was the first scene. And that alone was worth the price of admission for me. I don't know, this film, it has a bunch of stupid funny things and smart funny things, and it's generally a brightly colored diversion, but I don't feel the deeper levels that I usually feel in a Coen Brothers movie. And I know that a lot of people claim they're there, but this is one of those situations where I have to wonder if people aren't just seeing that because they know who the authors of the film are. If you showed this to someone and somehow they had no idea that the Coens made it, what would they think of it? And I think that in general, they'd say it's a thinly plotted, narratively uneven, indulgent, trifle. And that's fine. It's good in that way. There's a lot of stuff in this that's very funny. But I think it says something when you look at the poster and see all these faces, and they're there for sometimes only a minute, and you realize that the movie is just sprinting wildly through whatever the Coens feel like filming. And again, that's fine. They've earned it. The indulgences are fun in their own way, but there's just doesn't feel like there's a lot there. And that's about it. Everyone keeps saying Mannix is something the Christ figure of this film, but he doesn't really suffer at all. And he doesn't sacrifice anything, unless you believe that sooner or later his adorable doting wife is going to leave him, which maybe, but we don't really get that feeling.
He certainly slaps a lot of people around for a Christ figure.
Just like Jesus. Jesus slapped around some moneylenders.
That's true. Did Brian, did you get any enjoyment out of kind of the... Because I think with this film, more so than Inside Llewyn Davis, that was a singular character, and I will definitely agree that Andy Mannix is nowhere near as interesting as, the protagonist of Inside Llewyn Davis, or even a serious man. But I do like how I feel like the whole movie is, in a sense, commenting on the Coens' own relationship with Hollywood. And so I found that kind of interesting throughout. And I think that is kind of where the underlying messages are. The scene. Well, I don't know if we want to get into spoilers, but there's a lot there, I think, in terms of their relationship with making these studio pictures their entire lives, and that, well, leading, yeah, pretty much from the start after Blood Simple. But I just think there's a lot there we could discuss. And obviously I think this movie, they are going for more of, like you said, surface pleasures, but I think there is more to dive into. I don't know.
I mean, I guess, I don't know. I guess we will go into spoilers. There wasn't any character that I really... all the characters are one note. In Inside Llewyn Davis, everyone around him was kind of shrill in one note. But he was very deep and complicated, even in his shrill one-notedness. But... I don't know. In this movie, they're all just goofy little clown pawns to be knocked over and fucked up. I don't know. It never really connected with me, and the screwball nature of it at times, again, just it played like pantomime. It just wasn't working. I would still give this movie a C+ or a B-, but for a Coen Brothers film, I mean that's
pretty low. Yeah,
it is. It's incredibly low, and it gets by purely on its very well constructed charm, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. They don't have to make an Inside Llewyn Davis every time. Otherwise, they probably both would have killed themselves by now. And I don't want them to do that. So if they need to take some time to, stop painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and just have a paintball fight, that's fine. But I'm not going to say that the paintball fight is like a masterwork, the likes of which we haven't seen since Jackson Pollock. You know, it's fine that a movie is slight, and it doesn't have to have more. If you enjoyed it, you enjoyed it, and that's kind of how I feel.
What did we think of the length of the film?
Too long.
I could have stayed for much longer, but I do think
if this were like a series of YouTube videos that I could click through, then yeah, I would have clicked through bunch of them. But
I don't know what that has anything to do.
If I could just watch No Dames or Alden Ehrenreich try to do a screwball comedy, I'd be fine with it.
But there's so, like, the scene with Frances McDormand I thought was brilliant. I thought Tilda Swinton was brilliant. Like,
you could cut that scene out of the movie.
No. Oh my gosh, come on.
I understand that it may be making a point, but the movie itself doesn't serve a point, so there's no point to
if it didn't have all of these asides showing you kind of the behemoth that is a studio, then it wouldn't necessarily, the point, there would be no point. And I think that is the point, that is showing all these different factions and how they kind of intricately work together. Now he's at the center of it.
Narrative doesn't string them together enough to make it seem like they're all interconnected.
Well, I'm curious because, Jordan, you were mentioning how you think that this is kind of a reflection of how they feel about their own lives and their kind of work within the studio system and things like that. And I'm curious, you know, obviously Maddox is a studio head, right? He's kind of head of production.
He's not. And I do love how they keep mentioning a higher figure that's never shown. Skank.
The one that he keeps having to call from New York.
That was a real person, wasn't it?
The only real person is Eddie Man. Like, everyone kind of resembles someone, but the only real person is really Eddie Mannix, who himself, that's the only name that's used that's the same, but Eddie, but the Josh Brolin's character is not really like the real Eddie Mannix.
Anyways, so my curiosity kind of surrounds.
He was the president of United Artists.
Oh, there you go.
And then he helped to form Metro Golden Meyer.
All right. Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
Anyways, so my fascination is kind of where they see how they're represented, because Mannix definitely almost feels like a director in a way. Of all of these little tiny films that are kind of happening in his periphery, whereas I mean, what I'm trying to say is, do they see themselves as the role of Mannix in a way, because he keeps having to set out, you know, put out fires all throughout the filmmaking process of all these other different films, whereas obviously, you know, they're not making two or three, four different movies at the same time, but I guess maybe they kind of feel like they're constantly putting out fires, and it's a weird kind of way to envision their own viewpoint of themselves, as if, you know, they're constantly putting out fires. Because from my understanding, the Coen brothers sets haven't really made a lot of noise. There's not been a lot of things said about them. Of course, famously, they don't do it, like, any interviews, or, you know, very, very, very few.
Yeah, they do a few extensive ones, but they don't really tour the press circuit. I think for them, it's kind of it's like, you know, they edit their own films as well, so I think that's one aspect. But I don't think they see themselves as producers necessarily, but I think they've seen so much of Hollywood that they're commenting on all the different things they've seen, not necessarily that they've been a part of. Obviously, it's impossible to tell, considering how, like you said, how quiet they stay. The one thing I do love about this movie is how it kind of sets up these things, and then by the end, particularly a scene with Channing Tatum, it kind of becomes one of these movies, like this kind of over the top, green screen heavy, obvious, like 50s set kind of communist drama, you could say. So I like that kind of melding. I don't want to expand too much further on the other part, because I don't know how much they actually see. You know, they haven't said anything in that aspect. So I think they just kind of find things to poke fun at. And in this movie has been gestating for like 15 years. So
I was about to ask that, because I know they've they've kind of become much more, I don't know if it's just a selling point for a lot of films now, because the movie awareness of the Coens is that much higher nowadays than it was in the past. But they seem to be involved in a lot more productions now as either writers or producers or things of that nature, versus in the past it was just if they were writing and directing something. You know, whether it's something like Bridge of Spies, the Fargo TV series, Unbroken. Like, I mean, they either are producing things or writing things that aren't necessarily, you know, their own productions, that end up using their names as either a selling point or just, you know, like I said, just kind of a note that, you know, hey, you know, movie lovers, you recognize these names? Like, you should check this out.
Right, like Gambit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was quite a troubled one. But at least I feel like I didn't see Unbroken, but at least with Bridge of Spies, you could clearly tell what they had a hand in.
I still have not seen Bridge of Spies.
Look, and I've seen both of those.
Well, I was going to say, who else did you like kind of in the ensemble? Is there any highlights that you had? Obviously, we can talk about Alden Ehrenreich.
Yeah, he's obviously fantastic throughout the film.
I saw Alden Ehrenreich in the movie Beautiful Creatures.
That was a long time ago.
It was a real long time ago. So I, for my personal site, for a while I had a podcast.
Wait. There's so many damn movies with that kind of similar name. Beautiful Creatures, is that the YA adaptation?
Yeah. Southern Gothic witchcraft type of thing.
For some reason, I thought we were talking about like Beautiful Children or.
Oh, no, that's it.
There's so many damn movies with that kind of similar name.
No, anyway. Beautiful Creatures apparently came out in 2013. Oh my god. Well, I guess that's 3 years ago. Anyway. So, yeah, it's it was not a great movie. I had to see it because I was on a podcast where people voted for what they thought would be the best and worst films of the month, and then we had to go see them. It won the vote for the worst, and it wasn't awful. And much of what made it not awful was Alden Ehrenreich. And then I think later that year or early the next year, he was in Stoker.
Yeah.
So I've been waiting. I've been waiting for this guy to...
I mean, he's worked with... he was in Tetro, Francis Ford Coppola. He's worked with Woody Allen. He was in Blue Jasmine. He's in Warren Beatty's long... that shot like a year and a half ago, his Howard Hughes biopic. So he's been working with all these crazy talents. So it was kind of fun to see him, because I didn't watch any trailers or anything, so I didn't even know about the would that it were so simple, that whole exchange.
Would that it were so simple.
Which I love. And we can talk about Ralph Fiennes, who also steals that scene.
Lawrence Lorenz.
Yeah, but it was just kind of fascinating to see, you know, not knowing really who would show up when in this film and who would repeatedly show up. And it was so every time he kind of came back on screen, whether it was with like the lasso wrangling and the or anything like that, it was great to see his character kind of be more fully formed than the rest of the cast.
Yeah, no, he's a fantastic character that I would have loved to have seen more of, but we don't have that option. He's great. Channing Tatum, for his limited amount of time, is fun. David Krumholtz is funny, just like a harumphing guy in the background.
Alice Karpovsky as the the photographer, who has like maybe 5 seconds of screen time, but his glare is so funny.
Yeah, he takes a picture real well. There's good stuff in here. I mean, like I said, I'm not saying it's a bad film. I don't think that it does as much as people are claiming, or I don't think that they would be looking as much if it wasn't by the Coens.
That's a fair criticism and an unfair criticism at the same time, isn't it? I mean, the fact that it is the Coen brothers means that people are obviously going to dig because they dig.
This is the same type of... Okay, I'm going to stop myself from getting too angry. This is exactly what I talked about when I talked about something like Queen of Earth, We're like,
I didn't listen to that one.
Oh,
so
don't.
I also didn't watch that movie. So
yeah.
You know.
Well, don't do that either. there's a tendency to look at certain films by certain people in a certain way, and I don't think a lot of them deserve it. This uh-huh. one, I could take or leave if you wanna look at it and find, you know, Judeo-Christian symbolism. It's not hard. It's literally everywhere. You know, if you want to try to come up with some unified theorem, that's fine. You can do that. I won't be as mad at you as if you did it for Queen of Earth. But there's something weird where it is like, if I just sat you down and said, I made this, no one would give a shit. And I don't know if that's because I get very little credit for how incredibly intelligent I am, or I mean, it's I understand where if someone is constantly feeding you complex texts that you're going to assume all of their texts are complex.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that if it's not overtly clear that it is, maybe you could give it a rest.
I don't know if you're basing on my comments or others, but I don't think this movie is very complex, but I do think that
others. So
okay.
Don't worry about that.
Has there been a Coen Brothers movies maybe you felt similarly to, Brian, and then you revisited? Like, I would at least give them the benefit of the doubt where I would watch it again.
Intolerable Cruelty.
So you disliked that initially and then grew to like it?
No, I had the same feelings about Intolerable Cruelty that I had about this film. It's a delightful trifle, I think, is a thing that I've basically coined on this. It's not
but,
bad.
But you haven't had a film from theirs that you thought was surface level and then revisited and found a lot more.
No, I've never done that. But Jordan was asking if I found one that was like this film.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a good comparison.
This is better than Intolerable Cruelty because this one doesn't hang itself so much on plot. So it can skip gaily from scene to scene with nary a care in between. And it doesn't have to make sense. And
I guess
we're not in spoilers yet, but this falls under the possibly we could call it the Raiders of the Lost Ark effect, where much of what is done has no bearing upon anything.
I guess for me, I found so much enjoyment in that scene by scene aspect, even if they were kind of disparate. And I think, like I said, I already talked about how I think that is part of the reasoning of, you know, that's why there's a reason why they are so different. So that I got so much enjoyment that, like, immediately leaving this, I just could not wait to see it again, which I guess is, you know, what we differ in that you kind of just enjoyed what it was and then, you know, and then had your way with it.
If this were on TBS, I'd stop and I'd say, oh, very funny. And then I would move on, probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go into spoilers because we talked about spoilers.
Spoilers for this film. What is there to spoil here? Like, no one
well,
does
just
anything
certain things. Like, I for me, like, I loved his battle with perhaps wanting to work for the engineering company where it was going to be an easy job, yet that their main task was looking after nuclear bombs. Like, that's the equivalent of an easy job compared to a movie studio.
Protecting state secrets, somehow easier than managing a movie studio.
Exactly. And then the whole, I loved kind of George Clooney's, which felt, like I said, in the movie in itself, his whole journey, his own odyssey, you could say, where you don't really know what's going on in that room he goes into after getting kidnapped, and then it kind of slowly unfolds, and, you know, all the different characters and kind of the singular personality that they all have. And, you know, the final gag with Channing Tatum and the money and the dog. I loved it. And did you guys know that that was supposedly Dolph Lundgren as the
sub-commander?
As the sub-commander, yeah. He shot stuff for it and talked about it, but then you can make it, like, you know, you can make his profile, you can kind of see it, but anyways. Yeah, no, and so I love that aspect of I think it does give a little bit more depth to the movie, just Eddie Mannix's personal battle, which I've looked forward to revisiting. And it did feel, not to give this an excuse, because this was my only kind of negative thing going away, that it kind of ended abruptly. But again, I feel like movies of that era kind of do that, where the end comes up and it's right after they resolve a conflict. Whereas nowadays we're so accustomed to, you know, four or five endings. So I'm curious mm-hmm. on future viewings how that plays, knowing his initial journey or his the initial start of his journey. And you know, so I like
He doesn't go on a journey.
His 36-hour trip.
He seriously thinks about going to Lockheed.
No, well, the fact that he went to meet the guy twice, I think he does. And talking with his wife, that conversation, I definitely think he does.
I think he's definitely weighing it. Yeah. I think it's kind of her comments in particular that kind of settle him, because back then the dynamic was so different that, you know, I mean, he was the breadwinner and he basically made all the decisions about the household. And so it was like, do you want to actually come home to your wife and kids, or do you want this satisfying job that
this is about a man
is
who
difficult?
Actively tries to get away from his family?
I mean,
I think he loves what he does so much that it is that struggle, that internal struggle. That's why he goes to
a
confession booth.
I think he hates his family and doesn't want to be around them.
No, I don't think that's it at all.
He hasn't the dinner conversation where it's not like some throwaway line where he asks about how his son is doing and how his daughter is doing in class.
And he knows each one of them, like, oh, good, she was really studying hard for that test. And, you know, he knows, like, each of these small little details about their own interpersonal lives, that, you know, what they were doing at school. And so, you know, he can get that kind of reaction from, good, I'm glad. And look, like, back then, it really was kind of the way that a lot of parents raised their kids. The father was away and the wife was at home, and, you know, it just wasn't thought about that, oh, well, why don't you be home more often? Well, it's because I have a job and, you know,
in 10 years,
that's why I married you.
When those kids go to college, that woman's leaving him.
you think that's Mad Men kind of all over again?
Pretty much.
She's just waiting for them.
I was expecting to find out that she's like screwing the neighbor or was leaving him or something. Because,
well, you know, maybe she is. Who knows?
I don't understand. There's no point at which I thought, oh, he's going to take the job at Lockheed. So the fact that you all claim there's any kind of struggle is bizarre to me. It just never comes off.
It wasn't the film's main plot point, but it was kind of this thing that continually ran throughout the film where it measured what he was doing against another offer, like, or another opportunity. Whereas, so everything he was doing, you were kind of seeing, wow, he does really appreciate this. And so I think the film needed kind of that kind of angle to add to the rest of the movie,
I guess. But there's no, for me anyway, there's no sense that he wants that job in any way. They're like, hey, it's more money, and, you know, you're going to be able to go home to your family.
Well,
and, you know, these are all things like, that you could say would be temptations if he cared about his family and being around them, but he 100% doesn't. So,
we disagree.
There's no internal struggle or conflict for him at all.
But my thing is, you're saying, oh, like, what is his desire to go to Lockheed? Well, like, Brian, like,
he doesn't have one.
That's what I'm saying as well, is so many people have jobs that they do not like, that they do not enjoy on any level. And so it's just a way to make money so they can go home at night and have a roof over their head, feed themselves, clothe their children, do whatever they want to do outside of the job. And so, you know, you're saying, oh, this job didn't have any real pull for him. Well, welcome to like 90% of America.
But the pull ought to have been that he wants to spend more time with his family.
And I think that is hinted at.
I don't believe that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too.
When?
His own interest in his kids and his wife. And
I think his wife
academically is a man who has studied his family very well, but otherwise seems to give not a damn about them.
Well, I mean, how would you want that expressed other than him asking about his kids and knowing little details about their struggles with, you know, tests or baseball teams or things like that?
I mean, maybe have him like attempt to go to the baseball game and then get tripped
up. This is 36 maybe, hours, right?
What?
This is 36 hours.
The baseball game was that day.
Yeah.
He was supposed to talk to the coach about moving the kid to outfield that day because there was a game that day. And then when he gets home, he finds out that at the game, the kid played shortstop and he did really well. And now he's fine with being on the infield. Now, if he had in some way actually attempted to affect any change in that child's life or maybe make it to the game and then got sidetracked and then actually had like a moral debate about it, but instead he comes home and he's like, oh, I missed that. Oh, it worked out without me. Great. I can continue to neglect all of you.
the fact that he goes to the confession booth twice in this film, I think, is enough where he's...
Well, don't go to confession. Go home to your goddamn family, Eddie Mannix.
I think he's doing what is easiest in his personal life where he's... This is a five-minute thing I can do. And wash away my sins and then keep doing this. So I think...
Yeah. He puts all his energy into his work. And none of his energy and focus into his family life.
Right, because he doesn't care about them.
He's a workaholic.
Makes the job offer at Lockheed completely non-essential.
Did you guys find it interesting that I feel like every time I looked at his watch, it was exactly like on the hour?
I noticed the watch hands in this film are very, very particular. Like every time someone looks down at their watch or up at the watch, it seems like there's either on the minute or coming close to it.
The man's got a great internal sense of rhythm.
Yeah. It was just like this regimented chaos that was part of the movie where it's like, yes, there are going to be, you know, 10 productions at once or more, and yes, you have to fix all of them, and yes, this will happen on the dot.
Going into what you're saying there, if this movie has a quality that I admire, it is the fact that even though externally everything seems to be going crazy, Eddie has no problem with it. And you get the idea that this is not a particular day in his life. This is every day in his life.
Sure.
This isn't like, oh, Eddie Mannix only has 26 hours to... No, this is what he does. Like, he's unflappable. He doesn't care because this is the life that he lives and he's fine with it. Which is one of the reasons why I think that people might have given this a low cinema score grade. Because it really does seem like the movie was getting sold as... And you could tell... This is dumb. There's a point where he's running away from one of the gossip colonists.
Yeah, Tilda Swinton. Yeah.
And she is calling after him. In the movie, they've already finished their conversation. And so the movie tries to sell you this, poor guy is like in over his head, but he's not. He's fine. And I like that.
I mean, I wouldn't say the end of their conversation. I would say the point of her character is that it is a nonstop negotiation with the press about what is happening.
He's fleeing from her as she's calling out after him. He's
running after something else.
Yeah. In the trailer, it seemed like it was going to be a hilarious scene, and no, it was really just the end of it.
I think the scene with Lawrence Laurent is going to get a lot of praise and a lot of love, and rightfully so. But I think one of my favorite scenes is when he's carrying this briefcase satchel full of money, and he's trying to make sure that it locks down. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this conversation with and I can't remember his name. He's David. What is his name? The young
Doyle?
Actor. Yeah. And in the middle of that conversation, he looks over it and, you know, it's very obvious that the satchel has a lot of money in it. And he finally mentions it. And it almost seems like at first I thought Mannix thought that he was part of it. But instead, I'm even trying to remember like exactly the beats of that scene. But I just remember thinking that it was hilarious that at the end of it, he stands up and asks him for his belt.
I liked the entire little monologue about the extries.
I think it was a fun red. And to your point, Bill, it was kind of a red herring for Channing Tatum's character. Whereas it was kind of a climate where anyone could have been, you know, a communist at that point. So you weren't sure. And plus, like, of course, like the Western guy, like, you had no idea if he was like actually insanely smart or if like he just didn't know what he was doing.
Exactly.
I don't know. It was great. I don't know how much. Yeah. Something I want to bring up that, and if any listeners can attest to, but the extra on the cross as Jesus, someone said that was Michael Cera, or at least his voice. Yeah. I saw like at least 10 tweets about that and I had no idea. So I revisiting it again, I will look for that. But
yeah, pay attention to that, because they definitely paid a lot of attention to that extra.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's got to be someone. Okay, so also, I guess I'm used to like darker Coens.
Mm-hmm.
I was waiting for someone to die. Like, could not wait for someone to die. I thought that A, Hobie was going to die when he went to the communist place, and that was going to be the oh shit, it's real moment. And I would have been upset about that because I liked Hobie.
Yeah.
And then I thought that Josh Brolin had crucified himself.
Oh gosh. Well,
everyone's still alive at the end.
That's another point to like being a 50s S movie, where it is like this kind of, it's not vulgar in any way. It's kind of this light, like you said, could be considered trifle, but yeah. So I think that's one of the aspects of the film that I enjoyed, where that's one of the things I think it will have insane rewatchability, because it's just so damn fun.
Well, I mean, just recalling all these scenes now, like they just make me want to laugh, because there's so much just quick witted little things that just kind of add up over time. Like the way that the actress in Merrily We Dance keeps looking over at Toby with just this like level of disdain that he's even on her set. That, you know, she's making a movie with this guy. Because, I mean, in the reality of the film, she obviously knows that he's like this up and coming actor that basically has done nothing but ride horses his entire life. And it's just like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, are you serious? He rides horses. Why'd you dress him up?
So simple.
And I love his squeaky shoe. Oh, my gosh.
And his trouble with the door. There's a lot of vignettes that are great, but
I guess wrapping it up, just like I did like how a lot of the humor, or at least a lot of the thematic humor, was derived from kind of the more of the system itself than any. I mean, obviously, I love the scene by scene basis, but I do think, if you want to look deeper, it is this kind of whole system at play, which I enjoyed, and I guess, yeah.
Hmm. All right. Any final thoughts from you, Bill?
No, that's it.
All right. Yeah. Hail Caesar, out in theaters now. It's a fun romp.
One final thought, I guess. It's fun seeing Scarlett Johansson be a very vulgar, like, woman.
Vulgar. She's just an accent.
No. The way she says things and just the way she goes about her life seems very kind of just. It is not her typical role.
I guess I can get on that.
Yeah, it was against type for both her.
I mean, she's played an alien who kidnaps men and sucks.
Yeah, but she didn't say anything throughout. She talks throughout that entire film.
About to say, what are you talking about?
Nobody else does.
No, they talk a lot too. The men.
Yeah,
it's just hard to understand them because they're Scottish. Anyway,
everything needs subtitles.
Now that we've alienated the Scots, that's all for today. Thank you for joining us. Tune in next week. We'll be talking about Deadpool?
Yes.
Sure.
I guess so. Read my review. It's up. The embargo broke.
Indeed. So we do have that on at thefilmstage.com. We'll be talking about it next week. The week to follow, get ready, guys. We're all excited. We're going to be talking about The Witch, and I'm also hoping to see 999, directed by John Woodcote, the man.
Oh, yeah, that's the following week, I think. So
The same week as The Witch.
The Witch is nationwide on the 19th. They pushed it up.
Yes.
Which, let me just tell you that.
999 is the 19th, too.
No, 26th.
Damn it! so upset.
Seen The Witch at Sundance and not knowing what to expect, I kind of cannot believe it's getting a wide release. So I imagine it will have a similar cinema score, as in I will love it, but Yeah, it's this. It's a very strange film. So,
all right.
Well, it's A24, right? So,
yeah, it's A24.
And it's a wide release, which they don't do.
It's wide. That's what I mean. It's off the bat, it's wide. So, like, if you're going, you know, for a night out to see the latest horror movie and you get this, I would say it's like it's an Ingmar Bergman directed, like, a Ken Russell, like, meets Ben Wheatley kind of film.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, I get a very Ben Wheatley vibe from that film.
Yeah. It's, I loved it. But, yeah, I will be, for Hail Caesar, I kind of looked on Twitter, just not even people I follow, just random tweets to see what people thought. And I will certainly be doing the same for The Witch, because Hail Caesar was a bunch of confusion. And so I imagine The Witch will be the same as well.
I cannot wait for The Witch.
Well, I mean,
slowly grinding my way through the year until we get to that.
It's hilarious because the marketing for The Witch already is kind of confusing because people don't know whether to call it the Vitch or to call it The Witch. And it's just Vitch, like The Vitch. Anyways.
That is hilarious. And a perfect note to end this podcast on. So, gentlemen, let's tell the people where we can be found in the meantime. Jordan Raup, where can we find you online?
Yep, I'm on thefilmstage.com every day and at JP Raup on Twitter.
Bill Graham.
You can find me on The Film Stage. I just put a interview with Rosa Tran, the producer of Anomalisa, up on there. So that's something new. And you can follow me on Twitter at CableBFG.
You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, my personal site, dearfilm.net. And of course, you can find me writing at The Film Stage, thefilmstage.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Tune in next week.